They say I'm doing something full time, so I'm not doing stuff, if you notice, I'm not doing stuff.
It's okay. I brought a few things that I would like to say and that I mentioned before, and thank you very much. First of all, it's a very interesting, I got some notices. I thank you, each one and every one of you, for nice notes, because I got some nice notes from people. I think we have such an unbelievable week this week, isn't it? Every time I'm going home, I say to my husband, I'm getting high. He said to me, I'm a cheap date. I get high very easy. What happens is the following. You notice, of course, my spelling mistake. I mean, my students have a wonderful time with my spelling. They think it's so funny. So it's okay. They come into relief sometimes. My subjects are difficult. They have a good laugh. But,
where is the microphone then?
What happens is, I have a friend here. You come. She's going to look at all my notes and she's going to correct my mistake in the Freudian slip. Did you see yesterday the intersexuality? There is a young lady in Nicola Khalid, she's quite amazing, and she will put it with the notes. Also listening. I try to listen to my voice on the tape and I'm not such a short, so but maybe with the notes and the podcast it might be a very nice idea, because at least it makes sense a little more. So that will be the issue. How do you get onto it? So there is they said to me that each one of you has summer school book. And they say, here, it says www.ems.com/studies. So it's very easy, and then it says, according to the courses, you can click on the course button. And when you get to the course, it says podcast or notes or anything. So you can easily sit and listen to it. But if you don't move or something, that's...
But that's a good thing to know.
By the way, do you know that it's amazing when this young lady, Nicola, told me her name? I said to her, can you tell me the history of your family? And she said, why? And her grandparents were going from country to country. I said to her, I know. And she said to me, how do you know? Because, I said to her, because your name is Khalid. Khalid in Hebrew is a refugee who has to move from place to place. So somebody along the line named her, named them. You know, you remember we said that there were no surnames in ancient time, etc. So they were named according to this. I got here a very important note. The office said that there is a beautiful, I think it's a Molsky, because I went to see it. It's a diary of somebody. I didn't want to look because it looks like a diary, a personal diary, but on the front, one of the ladies said there is something Nazareth House. So if any one of you connected, or if you lost a diary, or if you hear somebody, I ask them to put it safely there for you. Wonderful, we're gaining a few minutes. So, and the book of Isaiah, there is a very interesting question about Isaiah and numbers of chapters. What happened, first of all, do you remember the chapters are not a division from the origin? No, there is echo. Not good. Yeah, but some people have hearing aids, which that is very painful. Is it okay? You let me know, okay, because it's very important to me that you will not suffer, that you'll enjoy yourself. Okay, the division of the chapters of the Bible is not initially. A man done it in the 16th century onwards. So it's quite an amazing. However, because this particular question referred to Isaiah,
The book of Isaiah has 66 chapters. The first part, 39 chapters, and then you have the 27. And if you read very carefully, the first part very much corresponds to the Old Testament or to the Bible, what happened, and the second part to the New Testament. But it's not surprising why Isaiah was the 8th century prophet, the original Isaiah, that reflects the 39 chapters reflecting on this. The next chapter, the end of Isaiah, is corresponding for a later period. It's closer to the New Testament. And therefore, the content, etc., is closer to the New Testament. Today, exactly. Somebody is very here. I have to be careful. It's funny, isn't it, that you have the spots of electricity. But I'll be careful. Okay. I don't know if you make something that is meaningful out of this. I do not at all put it down. If people see, get a lot of understanding and hints from a lot of things. But we will come towards the end of the lecture today. We will see how, if it makes sense to you or not. What are we doing today instead of cooking? I thought that I'll be here with 10 people because it's Friday afternoon cooking and transfer and traffic. So, but I still prepare and it's pulling today together because what happened until now, we learned a lot about the Bible. But we need to know, when I send you off and I say goodbye, see you in a few years or something, then I need to know that, okay, what does it help you to sit here the whole week? And I thought one of the things that is very helpful is we spoke about the content of the Bible, but we didn't speak about the transmission of the Bible. What language, what script, how it was, is it Korah, is it original, what went on. So it's a bit of a tour de force to it because we don't have as much time, but it's you'll get the hint. And the rest we will maybe correspond or we'll have future things together. I think it will pull a lot of the things for you together. Lecture four, five, I called it the word because it's issues of language and the meaning of the language. It's interesting for us to know who said what to whom. Did they say it or did they write it? And if they say it or they wrote it, in what language? And in fact, if they wrote it, in what script? It all is very important. So the language of the Bible is Hebrew. There is no doubt about this. The language is Hebrew. Daniel and Ezra and Nehemiah in Hebrew because it's reflecting the Persian time. In other words, they already lived in Babylon. In other words, they already it wasn't Hebrew, it was not their mother tongue. So these books, most of it, is written in Aramaic. Because by that time, that was the language that people spoke, Aramaic. And Aramaic is a sister language of Hebrew. Okay, here I gave you a note when you read it, or if you go to the computer to Google, it's not that important for you. What is important, there was a pro-Semitic language. Pro is the beginning, it's the mother of all the Semitic languages. It was in the part of Asia, in the part of Africa, where Ethiopia is today, and all the place in Israel, to the Fertile Crescent, all the way to Iraq, so of today. So it's the Fertile Crescent. It was Semitic languages. What is Semitic languages? So a lot of them died. One of them I had to learn. Not enough that I had to learn alive languages, I had to learn a dead language, because you get some good biblical archaeology from this language. It's dead, nobody knows even how to pronounce it, but we can read from it and I can decipher some things about the Bible. But it's Ugarit. Akkadian is from the Aramaic, it's very similar. Semitic languages have something unusual, and it's everywhere has a root of three letters. These three letters have to repeat. You can pronounce it differently, so Katav is Yirov, Ktiva is writings, Hachtava is dictation. So Katav, Kotev, Chtav, everything with KTV, something to do with writing. It's a very, very
easy language in a way, Hebrew, because it has the logic in it. So what did the characters, what in the Bible, what did they speak? They spoke Hebrew, but you remember that I already, that's why I said this lecture pulled together. You remember I said to you that the lingua franca, the language of the people around, was Aramaic. And each tribe spoke their own mother tongue. I think we should learn from them in South Africa. Each one has their indigenous language, be proud of it, etc. That's fine. But they, when they had to speak between them, all of them, they had Aramaic. And many of them called the name of town, like Tsova. They called it Aram Tsova. Meaning maybe there were other Tsova at the Fertile Crescent, but they are the ones that spoke Aramaic. Maybe there is Tsova that only speak Egyptian or something. There is Aram Damascus, Aram Maha, Aram Naharaim. So indicating that these people belong to this, like NATO, like European Union. They spoke Aramaic between them. The Hebrew was not called at the time Hebrew. It was called Yehudit. It makes sense in a way because it referred to the people of Yehuda, Judea. So, by the way, do you know that the word Jews, it's a lazy word. In German it's called Falun. The word Jews did not exist until they were exiled to Rome. It's after Jesus died. They took them to Rome, and when they asked them, who are you? They said, we are the Jews, the Judeans. And from Jews, it came to be Jews and Finnish. But here, can you see again, from the word Judea, Jews, the language was called Yehudit. And it's the reference. But you remember that I start when the first lecture I opened with the time frame, I say 2000 before the Common Era was the forefathers, the foremothers, and then only in 1500 onwards they start writing at Moses' time. Now, to talk to my children, say, how do you know it's Moses? I know that they think I'm old, but I'm not that old. I don't know. It might not be Moses, it might be his cousin. It doesn't matter. History tells us that around 1500 BCE, there was the invention of the ABC. Now, everything that happened between 2000 to 1500 was transmitted, obviously, by oral literature. So the whole book of Genesis, the whole book of Genesis is actually was a, can you remember details of conversation 500 years later? You remember we spoke about Auntie Mel? Yes. What did she tell you last Passover? You don't even remember. So how do you remember 500 years later? Now, even it's not only worrying me that people quote and ready to die for the conversation that happened and somebody quoted 500 years later. What is interesting, even if they wrote at the same time, how do you know conversations if people say it in a private conversation? I just gave two silly examples of something, but it says, Ehud went to King Eglon, and he sent off everybody, and it says, that's what it ticked me off, because it says he sent everybody off out of the room. And then he said to Eglon something, and then there it is, he kills him, unfortunately. But can you see, so if he was alone with him, how do you know? Do you think that Ehud went out home and he said, allow me to write it in my diary, which I forget it's useful anyway? So I don't think so. So it's very, one has to be very cautious about conversations that happen in private. What about Nathan, the prophet, said to Bathsheba, look, let's have the following plan. And they discuss something that they will go to David, and she will remind David the conversation that they had in the past and in which David promised that her son will be the king. David by that time was Alzheimer's. Do you think he remembered? I'm not joking. It says he was very old, he was cold, he couldn't... he was not in full capacity. He couldn't really rule. So maybe it was a ploy between Nathan and Bathsheba. Maybe the conversation with David and Bathsheba never happened. We don't know. But what is for me amazing is how this conversation, which was in private and supposed to stay private, maybe Ehud want to tell everybody what happened, but they for sure didn't want. How does the writer know what the person said in her heart or his heart?
There is a wonderful story that the angels say to Sarah and Abraham in Genesis 18. He says, next year we're coming to visit and you will have a baby. So Sarah laughed in her heart. And the angel, that didn't look like an angel, he looked like a normal visitor, and he said to her, why are you laughing? Now, in other parts of the Bible is also, when somebody say in their heart things, it appears on the text, in the text. So how do you know this? By the way, I mentioned here something cute that this chapter taught me fact. You know why?
Because she said they're both of them old. I don't think there was a great sex competition there.
And she say, she doesn't blame him, but she say, I'm past my time. She definitely referred to periods. What a clever woman. Before Hippocrates worked out that pregnancy had to do with women's cycle. I'm talking about a good 2000 years before Hippocrates. And she said, after my times are up, when I'm old, suddenly it will come. And she also referred to her husband old age. So we realize that both of them are not exactly very active. But when the angel refers to something, she does not mention, she does not discuss her husband. And I thought a lot of young people should learn.
Between you, what you say is good, but don't ever discuss your husband out of home. Or your wife, for this matter. Now, what's more authentic? If closer to the Ur text meaning the original text, the poetry or prose? And many scholars claim that the biblical poetry is more authentic and closer to the Ur text. We have only two examples, you remember, of poetry and prose together. We already mentioned yesterday the Song of the Red Sea, there is prose story and the poetry, and the Dvorah poems, etc. But in general, most scholars agree that the poems are older, and it actually is closer to the original text. Less editing, more original. Why? It makes sense. When my students didn't agree with me, I had to devise a ploy how to convince them. So what did I do? I took three students out of the class. We took one in and we said to him, can you say little Miss Muffet? So he said, little Miss Muffet sat on the carpet, eating her pears and went. And along came his father, who sat down beside her, and fried Miss Muffet away. Wonderful. We bring number two. Number one said to number two. Okay? Then we bring number three. Number two read to number three about by heart, not reading, saying it. And it was word by word. Nothing was changed. Now, I said to them, okay, will you tell a story? Let's have Goldilocks. Comes number one, we tell the Goldilocks. When he tells Goldilocks to number two, he will not believe what they ate, what they omit, what. Why? Because everybody brings their own little goldy thing into the story. In poetry, you can't do it. You have rhyme, you have rhythm, you have number of syllables that you can say, and this is what saved the poetry and kept it as ancient, more ancient than the prose. The prose was much more edited and biased. Okay, so what language God spoke? Was God speaking Hebrew? And if God spoke Hebrew, then all the people could hear him, isn't it? Or God's speech. Maybe hear, yes, but could not understand. Could they understand God? And if God didn't speak, he just spoke God's language, so were the prophets
just translators that translated into for the people? So what is the issue here that I try to bring is what language God spoke and what was the role of the prophets?
If God spoke a divine language and people could not pick it up, except for the prophet, then the prophets are actually translators. And if they are just translators, that translation is never very accurate, isn't it? Or what happened is if a word has two meanings. The prophet has to choose. Do you know that in homophones, you have homophones? The best example, I'll come back to it. The best example is the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments appear twice in the Bible. Of course, when God gave it to Moses in Exodus 20 and also in Deuteronomy. And of course, the commandment about the Sabbath, it says, remember the Sabbath, the Shabbat. But in Deuteronomy, it doesn't say remember the Shabbat, it says keep the Shabbat. So what did God say? Did God say the word remember, zachor, or the word shamor? Did he say keep it? And we don't know. And the rabbis have a problem with this because the rabbis are fundamental. They have to go for every word exactly as the text says. So they have a problem. And one of the rabbis, a mystic, one of the people that involved in the Kabbalah, he says something very nice. He said, in God's language, zachor and shamor is one word. In God's language, the word to keep and guard is actually only one word. So the prophets had to decipher it, so they gave one version, they said, remember and this. Why did I mention this? Wait, don't go, do you want water? Okay. Some languages have vocabulary that others don't have. For example, bon appetit.
How you say bon appetit in English?
You just say bon appetit, isn't it? How do you say Gesundheit? You know, Optik, Gesundheit.
You don't say it because it's very English to keep your upper lip. Don't refer to anybody's sneezing or food, just keep going up nicely. But food in France is, that's why it's a bon appetit. In Hebrew comes from Yiddish, a word that maybe one day I'll translate it into English, I'll invent it in the English. And it's called mefargen. Let me move from the mefargen. Mefargen is when somebody is happy for you when you succeed. When a colleague heard about a certain conference that is important for me, about Bible or something, she couldn't make it because she can't, it's not exactly, she knew that she would not be invited. She phoned me. It cost her time and money and everything. She praised me overseas and she said, Silly, go to this, the days we have from here will cover for you. This is called mefargen. I looked for it in English. Any variation of it, it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist in many languages. What does it tell you about humans if we are not happy for others? So there is sometimes that if the prophets were only translators, then there is a problem there that many times maybe we didn't understand God's words. Also, for example, the Bible, when Moses see God in the bush, and he said, Moses was very not fearsome, but he said, no, I don't want to go, I don't think I'll be good, and I can't speak, and all this. And God said, I will be with you. And he asked God, what will you be? I mean, will you be directing me or something? God said in Hebrew, I will be who I will be. Meaning, whatever you will need, I will be this. He wanted to support him and to strengthen him. But in English, why does it, all the Bible that I check, and I always have Bibles from all around the world, all the English say, I am what I am. So I asked my friends from the English department, why didn't they leave it? I will be what I will be. And they said, it's very flippant. It's like, I'll be what I'll be. It doesn't sound good. But can you see, because it doesn't sound so good, meanwhile you change God's word. Who are we? It's a very arrogant thing, isn't it? I think, I will be who I'll be. That is much nicer. There is obviously powerful translations that it's went around the world. The word Tzela. Tzela is a ring. You think. It says that God took, when he put Adam to sleep, it's in Genesis 2, he took a tzela out of him and he made it into a woman. So, all English translations say that he took a rib out of her. Why? Because the next verse says, you are a bone of my bone, the skin of my skin. But a bone of my bone, the skin of my skin,
is an Ethiel, meaning you are mine and unused forever. It appears in many places, other places, nothing to do with a bond. It's an idiom. So why did they choose rib? Because you know, a rib, in Hebrew, by the way, the word tzela means a side. God divided the first human into half. Half of it is a man and half of it is a woman. We are not, I always say that people laugh, and it is funny, but I'm not talking the Bible. But we are not little lamb chops. We are not little and a little part. We are totally equal half of the human race. So how come from the first translation onwards we became a little chop? A little. And this is coming. It's coming from the Greek translation. The first Greek translation say Costa. Costa can be side or rib. When they later on, when the English people had to translate it, they looked at it, they said, at that time a woman was not equal. So they said, surely it's not a side, a costa, it's not a side. So it must be a rib. And the word rib got into the Bible, and the women's situation is getting better, actually. So there is a harmful translation, so one has to be careful. There is a patronizing example, and I told once before, it's in the New Testament it is, and it says, I think in Matthew, that God said, who was the last? Maybe Matthew. He was walking and he hit a shipwreck. It means he came to a disaster. It's an idiom. He met with a disaster, a shipwreck. Ship, S-H-I-P. Wreck. Now, like the Italian one that went now at the same ship. Now, the causal translation of this idiom changed to when his calabash fell on the ground and spilled. So I say, I spoke with this group that translated the Bible. And I said to him, it's a guy from Athens, and I said to him, Minister, why did you not write shipwreck? Why did you write a calabash? He said, no, the Kosa people are not ship people. They are not seafarers. And I was very upset, because what a patronizing attitude. Can you imagine? Sorry? You imagine in the Bible that there will be no idioms? There are some images, beautiful images about snow. I haven't seen a snow being growing up in Israel. I haven't seen snow till I was 20-something. Now, will somebody change my Bible and take away the word snow on the mount of the Hermon? No. This is abhorrent. So why are we doing this to the Kosa? So one has to be very careful with translation. Translation is a dangerous thing. Now, of course, it can be a personal bias. First, look at me and then I'll explain to you. Then we'll read it together. Look, because it's a long... What happened is the following. When Moses had a preparation for the Ten Commandments, he went on Mount Sinai. He was a very good organizer, because he didn't just go and say, give me the Ten Commandments. He went to negotiate the conditions and everything first. So when he came, God said to him, okay, in a few days you must come up, in 3 days you come up back, and by that time I'll give you the commandments. But, alas, in these 3 days you must tell the people the following. And God said to him the following. You must tell the people to sanctify themselves, to wash their clothes, and during the event, you know, the epiphany, you know, this like, wow, they should not touch the mountain. Now Moses goes down, and look, it's the next verse. Moses goes down and he says, sanctify yourself. Can you see, sanctify yourself? Wash your clothes. Wash your clothes. And don't come to your wife.
I think he thought what he can't do, he doesn't want others to do.
Well,
the idea that they mustn't come near their wife come from? And this is Moses, the father of all prophets, and this is recorded. How many times it was by minor prophets, and it was not recorded? And we read it, and we think this is God's word. So one has to be careful, always remember that it's transmission, and something can go wrong. Okay, this one, I told you the biases about the Tzela, which is this, but I need to tell you about this. In the same group of scholars who translate the Bible, the one that I spoke about, Koza, a young Dutch lady stood up. She was maybe 25, you know. I just love these pretty girls, they are so clever. It's like, oh. And she's saying, because it's a special group, it's called the working group of the translators around the world, Bible translators. So you have only the experts. They don't allow an open session. Only the experts. And she say, have you seen the most recent and the most modernized translation of the Bible into English? So of course, the two main translators, it's a few people always, but the two ones that have been responsible for this stood up very proud. She said, okay, you can sit on the cube. So everybody clapped hands and everything. And she said to them, ladies and gentlemen, I want to tell you something. Look at Genesis 25. And everybody curiosity went up. What is Genesis? First of all, to know about the Bible. When anybody talks in the Bible, it says the word say. So God say, Abraham say, Sarah say. Even if they ask and answer, even if they command, even there is no word God commanded. It says God say. This is say. It's quite beautiful because it's not very exciting. You remember we spoke that it's not emotional book. It's book that keeps, and you have to make sense of things that happen. So the word is say. She said, gentlemen, would you like to open the Bible? And they opened it. She said, have a look. When Jacob said to Esau to go and hunt for him for having food, he says, it was Isaac. He says, Isaac said to Esau. Isaac called, he commanded him to go and he commanded, he told him two words. Not say, the word in Hebrew is say. He told him and he commanded him. And when Rebecca, 3 verses later, said to Jacob, go to the yard where the animals are and bring me. You know, she told him to make some pottage, to make the food that the father had. It doesn't say, say. It doesn't say, Rebecca, say. It says she pleaded. She asked. She said, excuse me, what comes translation? Men command and told, the woman plea and ask. The Hebrews say the same word. Very neutral, very exact. Are you with me? So translations are, a lot of it, it's the biases of the, you know that these two men stood up, and I think they should be Jewish in Yom Kippur, you know, the Day of Atonement. They went one and they say, you know, we are so sorry. We haven't noticed it until somebody indicates. They've been quite ashamed. They said, we are so sorry. We thought this wonderful and we just finish it and it's published around the world in thousands of copies. And the new version has to be the new rework. I just bought, since artists are also translators of sorts, then I thought I'm going to bring you two examples of mistranslations. You are going to have quite fun with this, because I did, so I know that this is fun. And the first question is, what fruit was the serpent trying to give Eve? What did he convince her? Now, thinking like I'm a mentalist. Today was a program on the radio, a mentalist. I'm a mentalist. What fruit did he give them? The day you eat thereof, your eyes will be opened, and you will be as God, knowing good and evil. Does it say the name of the fruit? No. But you see, evil bed in Latin is malum. Of course, you know it from the word malis. Okay. But malum also is an apple. So people that read it fast, they did not read it the fruit of good and evil, they read it the fruit of apple. Can you see? Nice, isn't it? Can you see? There is more exact, but I just loved it because Tizian, who doesn't know Tizian? The Italian, and he said, look at the beautiful apples. I just, while I was collecting pictures, I thought you'd like this one also.
For a 12-year-old Israeli guy, excuse me, if it's a tree of knowledge, he must have glasses. Not like this little boy, he has glasses. So he thinks that if you're clever, you must have glasses. And of course, if it's a tree of knowledge, computers and books must be there, isn't it? I thought that this is amazing. This is so cute.
But can you see that each one translates from their own heart, from their own life experience? Now, when Moses brings down the Ten Commandments, I'll read to you, it says, when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets, he knew not that the skin of his face shone, Karan, because he had spoken with God. Now, the word Karan is his face radiated. So how did the artist interpret? Look how beautiful. He has this radiation, two-ray sunshine rays. That's, I think, that is, he hit it on the nail. His face shine like the sunshine. Are you with me? Aha. That is to shine, Karen, Karan. You remember that? By the way, the name Karen or Karen for a girl is beautiful because it means sunshine or a ray of sunshine. So, however, it also denotes a horn. So the Peshadure made Moses shining. He chose number one. But Michelangelo selected possibility number two. Look at his Moses. It's a very famous sculpture with horns. Why would Moses have two horns? So if you know the Hebrew, obviously, you know what happened there. It's like the apple of Genesis. He made it by mistake. Okay. Translations are never like the original. Therefore, there is a Muslim prohibition on translating the Quran. Is it good? Yeah, there is something very good about this. However, what about accessibility? The Muslim children, they go to the madrasa in the afternoon and they learn the Quran to recite it by heart. But they don't know the meaning of the words. And sometimes, I have a friend, some of you know Anwar Moy, he's from the medical school. He's a fantastic teacher and wonderful person. And he said to me, it's very comforting to just recite. Like there is an echo. I'll move away. There is something very comforting about reciting a prayer, even if you don't understand it, because it's beautiful. It's like when you do the Indian things or meditation. However, we want to know the meaning, and therefore, I think it's important for us to learn a little bit about biblical translations. So, as long as they spoke Hebrew, they were in the land. They did not need translation. It was their mother tongue. Okay? So, when Abraham spoke Hebrew, Moses spoke Hebrew, you remember our time frame? So, 2000 spoke Hebrew, Moses, Hebrew, David, 1000 spoke Hebrew. They went on exile, they spoke Hebrew. But second and third generation in the exile, they did not speak Hebrew anymore. They spoke Aramaic. Because they move, bless you, Gesundheit, you see, it doesn't exist in English. So, what happens is, they decided to translate the Bible into Targum, which means Aramaic. The Aramaic translation of the Bible into Aramaic of the Torah is called Untelus, and the prophet was by Jonathan. We think Jonathan Ben Uziel. So we think it's the names of the people that were responsible for this. It's not necessary, but it's possible. I don't know. Now, they did not write it down.
in the beginning. Because it is not holy. It's not supposed to, they realize that. So what the translation for? When Ezra and Nehemiah came back to Israel, and on Saturday morning they read the Torah, they realized they talked to themselves. Because they lived in Hebrew. Torah, nam 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 nam. Nobody understood. So the tradition was that somebody read it in the Hebrew, and the person standing next to them and translate it into Aramaic. That is the first translation of the Bible into other languages. It was by heart, Ezra and Nehemiah. However, people wrote it slowly down because they wanted to keep it. And also, what happens is that the Jews, a lot of the people, when they took them to exile, to the north, to Mesopotamia, some of them, like Jeremiah, went down to the south and they settled in Egypt. And there was a big, big Jewish community in Alexandria and in Egypt. They did not speak Egyptian. No. At the time they spoke, as you know from Cleopatra and later, they spoke Greek. So though the word Egypt, don't be fooled, we're talking about a Greek translation. Now the community could sort of decipher a little of the Hebrew, or the rabbi could read it, etc. But they needed to understand and they wanted to translate it. And the rabbi said no. Almost like now I say about the Quran. However, you know the power of the message is bigger than the voice of one rabbi or something. And they made a translation of the Bible into Greek. And it became very, very important translation. Now, why is it called the 70? There is a magnificent story. We have an epistle. Epistle is Igeret. You know what is epistle with my accent? Am I saying it correctly? It's a little letter, document. And in the epistle of Mr. Aristias, he tells the story of the first translation of the Bible into Greek. You see, there was a lot of opposition to it. So they wanted to give it legitimation. Because the rabbis, you know, one of the rabbis, he was a for you Christian, it might be very interesting also, because one of the rabbis was the teacher of Jesus. And he decreed that if there is a fire, and the Torah is in the synagogue, and the Torah is getting on fire, you risk your life, and you get the Torah out. Because it's a word of God. There is something more than just a parchment there. It's emotional. But he said that if there is the same fire and there is a translation, the onkelos of the Greek one is in the fire, he said, don't bother. Obviously, he wanted to show that the Hebrew has, because of the originality that was probably the spoken word, there is something more than just scribble, scribble. Whereas it's another language, it's already, we all know by now that it's carrying biases and issues of translations and linguistics, etc. So that's why. Now, Igeret Aristias wanted to give the Greek, they realized that the rabbis, the sages, don't want to give it the honor that it deserves. So there is a legend. How did the Greek translation happen? Apparently, according to Igeret Aristias, the epistle, you know, in Alexandria there was a huge library. So the king said to send, somebody told him, do you have the Bible? And he said, no. What's the Bible? They said, oh, what are you talking? It's the book of all books. They've been in the summer school, obviously. Yes. Now, when the king said, what do you mean? Is it such an important book? Then we must have a copy of this. He said, yes, but the language is a strange language that we don't know. So he said, okay, and according to Igeret Aristias, I don't necessarily believe that that's what happened, but that's a very nice story. Look at the legend that associated this. According to this, they sent six representative sages, the cleverest people of each tribe. 6 times 12 is 72. So they came down to Egypt, and the king put them on an island, on a place, the epistle describe it, it's like a key. And with rooms they built for them along the key, so they've been separated by water and everything. each one. Every morning after they ate, each one went to their room and they were given a chapter or two or however they had to work. And in the evening, they had to come together and compare the notes. And miraculously, 72 people have the same word by word in the Greek. Meaning, can't you see how holy is the Greek translation? So, the 72, by the way, you don't say the Septuagint plus 2. You just call it the 70, but it's the 72, obviously. So the Septuagint, which means the 70, is more important, or people give it more weight than other more modern translations. Now, after we talk about the year 270 or something, anyway, before 245, Origen's wrote an hexapla. Hexapla is the six columns. And guys, if I go to upstairs when I'm dying, and God will ask me, what would you like to see before you come here forever? I say, I would like to see the hexapla. Why? Origen done something amazing. In the six columns, column number one was the Hebrew. Column number two was the Hebrew transliterations. Don't you want to know how you pronounce words? Do you know that some of the words we cannot pronounce until today properly? We have some questions about in Amos. There is some word that I always not so sure if it's pronounced today as it used to be. Can you imagine if we will have access to it? Then came Aquila, which is Greek translation, very, very much like King James, very loyal, very loyal. It's literal. Then Symmachus was another Greek translation, but it's more idiomatic. So it's nicer English, but sometimes it's changed. I hope it's not changing like this, because of translation. But it's not as distant, it's not patronizing, it's just more, they try to make it more beautiful Greek. And the last one was Theodosian, that is just, it's a Jewish Greek man, so it might be that he had a lot from the Septuagint. But anyway, don't you think that this is something that we could really forbid the scholar? But it's gone. It's gone, it might be gone in the fire in somewhere in Alexandria or in Caesarea. This is something that I often. Then Jerome had a Latin translation, the Vulgate, which is the Vulgata, what we call in Hebrew, a very famous one, but it's so people that learn Latin. It's interesting for them. Now, meanwhile, let's talk about the script. The Hebrew alphabet is the first alphabet in the world. Sometimes it is called ancient Hebrew or Phoenician. Why Phoenician? It has nothing to do with the Phoenicians. But the Phoenicians were the sailors. So when they took it, they were the ones that when they sailed around and they go to Italy, they go to Crete. Crete was a big island with a very cultural center or something. So they took it. So when people say something, they say, hey, look, we have alphabet. The Phoenician brought us the alphabet. Before this, there were two systems of writing. One was the cuneiform. Cuneiform is just like pressing the reed into the stilt or whatever it's called, into a clay. It's very small tablets usually. Very, you can't make it up unless you know the code. And hieroglyphs, it's code. You have to know what it is. But if you see an I, then you realize it's something to do with. So it's between just code, between pushing things, and a real picture. So if you have the scepter or the snake, it's the king because it represents the king. If you see like this, they're walking. If you see a mouth, it's eating. But you see, it's not a good thing because you don't know from the mouth if they ate, if it's an invitation for a party to come and eat for dinner, or anything. You just know it's something to do with food. You cannot have in these two systems an abstract thinking. The brilliance of the alphabet is that suddenly you can express abstract things. The limitation is that it's record only consonants, because
At the time they invented, what does it mean consonant? They say,
if I want to write Moshe, Moses, Moshe, so I would use M,
M. How would I draw M? Mime, water. Mm. So I will draw here water. Can you see the water? The M.
So that is the Mem, and this is Shen. Shen is tooth in Hebrew. Look at my teeth. It's like a rabbit tooth. My dentist is better than this one. So when they want to write Moshe, they wrote M, She, and finish. They don't need O, they don't need something. If it's a mother tongue, you can decipher it easily. If I give you the words David's room, if I write D, V, D, R, M, you would look at it a minute or two, and you would pick it up that it's David's room. For a non-speaker, that's a bit of a problem. Can you see? When it's not your mother tongue. So when Moses invented, sorry, it's not so clear because I enlarge on it. But just to show you, this is a bet, because the word bet is bite. It's a home. It was a home with the parameters. This is a hook, vav. Can you see the vav? It's a hook, very clearly a hook. So, hook. Are you with me? When you stick something on the door. So this is it. This is mime. This is kaf. It's kaf yad. It's a hand, a palm of the hand. Can you see? By the way, can you see? I once traced how these letters turn into English. Can you see the K? Can you see where K comes from in English? It's K, from the Hebrew directly. That is mime, and that is a head, rosh. You can see the neck, and you can see the head, resh. So the resh is this, shin is this. That's a cough. That's a needle with a thing of the needle. How do you call the hole of the needle? That's the needle eye. So in Hebrew, it's kuf, kuf of the eye.
So the Hebrew letters, in fact, have names. It's describing things. The first that I can show you clearly,
a stone or something of the script, is very beautiful. And I can even read it easily because it's from the time of King Solomon. It's about 1,000 years before. It's 3,000 years ago. A little boy, I think, wrote it. And he wrote his name, his Avi. And I'm not joking. That's the Aleph, and that's the Bet, and that's the Yud. So it's Avi, sideways. But it looks like a practicing of writing. But what I wanted to show you here, it's Yarcho Asaf. That's the month, That's the month of collecting, gathering the fruits. And that is Yarech. It's another month. So obviously, it is known as the Gezer calendar. It was found in Gezer in Israel. And it's the calendar. You can see what did they do on this month. And then after the month, and on etc. The only thing is, how do you know when one word ends and the other one starts? You don't. And by the way, this is not the end of the word. It's continuing here. So there is no breaking into words, is not breaking into sentence, no nothing. It's a very complicated. Again, if it's your mother tongue, you can do it. I can easily read it. But if it's not your mother tongue, I just show you, look how it looks on some of the scriptures. This is, by the way, if anybody was in Jerusalem, this is the most amazing. I will not stay too long, but I want to tell you a story. Can I tell you a story?
Yes.
It is so interesting. This thing, guys, is a stone in the wall in Jerusalem. And you can go into the tunnel, and you see this. And I'm talking about a stone from 700 before the Common Era. So it's 2,712 years ago. And it says like this, the content of it, it says, while we are knocking, building the tunnel, we can hear the builders knocking from the other side. Now tell me about engineering. We talk about 2,500 years ago engineering. They needed to build the tunnel out of the town in case the Babylonian people came. And by the way, that's where the tunnel that they ran away. And they needed a tunnel in order to go and collect water if Jerusalem is dry. They build for kilometers long. Where is the compass? Where is the engineering team? How did they work it out? And the wording here in ancient Hebrew, it's amazing. I worked it out. And it says, we can hear the builders knocking from the other side, and we are going to meet them now. The anticipation in the word, this is so wonderful. If you're ever in Jerusalem, you must go into, it's called the Silwan. I wrote to you, quickly, all the name. In Hebrew, it's the Shiloah. In Arabic, it's, in English, Silwan. And the Arabic is Silwan. The inscription from Sinai.
Isn't it amazing? I think this is fantastic. Now, the technical improvement, of course, is people decided it's more and more difficult to read when the words are stuck. So they divided words. They put between words a dot. That's a beginning. By the way, they still, if the word had to continue, they just continue the next line. Because today you can go to CNA or something and buy more, another ream of paper. In ancient times, to look at pilots or a stone, the words on clay was very difficult. So they say they didn't just finish in the middle of the line. They tried to write until the last millimeter and continue, even if it's in the middle of a word, they continue. But nevertheless, I must say that if they start marking the end of word, they start marking the end of sentences, and etc. And then the most important guys, and this will come back just before I finish the lecture today, it's called the Madre Lecciones. Madre is a mother, Lecciones is letter from elocution. It's letters that help you to read. It's vowel letters, Madre Lecciones. Now, of course, if you can't read something, and you know, if it's your mother tongue, you know you have to pronounce the word law or poor. So, but if you are not English speaking, you just see the L or the T and you are not so sure if it's pa, pu, pi. So, they start inserting some of these mother letters. There are four mother letters in Hebrew. One for O, one for A, one for E, and one, not for E, but it's something in between, so they can work out. However, and here is the most important point I want to make because I come back to it, it's an unsystematic, inconsistent. Utah, is it properly written? Inconsistent and sometimes erroneous. And there are, it's a problem with this because one reader or the one that scribed that copy, he thought, no, they will not be able to read it. And while he copies the Bible, he sees this word, I must put the O. And he put the mother like O. But the same word in another context, he didn't feel that he needs. So he didn't add it. So not all the words have been, while they were copied, are spelled the same because the mother letters in some of them appear. Here I just picked up something beautiful. Can you see already the division into words, guys? Lecha, ze, Torat. Hamelech, Melech, final letter, guys. So it's quite Chodesh. So it's quite nice. That's the development. There is already mother letters here. There is ha, ha, to say lecha, ha. That's the H. Some things are moving forward. Now I want to show you example of a spelling error that it's due to the unsystematic insertion of a vowel letter. The book of Job is a philosophical book. How a righteous man, that doing the absolute right thing, why would he suffer? It's totally un-Jewish, because they, you know, if Christianity emphasizes love, Judaism emphasizes usually it's about justice. You know, we are the Libra. If you're good, you'll be rewarded. It's not arbitrary. And by the way, Islam, because we are three very similar religions, we are reading the same text, Islam emphasizes sovereignty. They say in Allah. So it's very similar religions, but each one. Now, if you build your own religion of justice, how can a righteous man like Job suffer? So there is a whole 40 chapters of debate and philosophical issues about justice, and there is no answer. Job's friends don't give him good enough answers. Even God doesn't give him good enough answers. God answers.
Do you know where the wind comes from? He said, no. He said, do you know where the water, the rain will come? No. You don't know so many things, so what do you worry about? God just telling you humans don't know everything. You just have to take it and go along. It's an interesting. Very difficult. But the nicest thing that I'll never forget, it's Job 13. Please remember these numbers, guys. Whoever is a religious or spiritual person. Job came to God and said, I'm satisfactory. He argued with God and he said, this is not a good answer. But he said, though, even if he will kill me, even if he kills me, I don't like the translation. So though if he will slay me, yet I will yearn for him. I will not break. Maybe I don't understand everything or something, but even if my faith is not what I think I deserve, I still yearn for him. Only I will argue my own ways before him. That's very Jewish way. Abraham argued with God and said you shouldn't do this, etc. But he said, I think that this is if you ever. The only problem is law. Even if you will kill him, I will yearn to him. To him. This is to him. I will look up to him. The spelling mistake of one of the scribes, he wrote it with law, with Aleph. It's another vowel letters, Aleph, and it means no. So if people don't know about spelling mistake, that it sometimes infiltrates into the text, then you will read it and say, even if he kill me, then I'm not missing him. So why even? Then the sentence is not understood. Are you with me on this? When they wrote it down. And when systematic, that's exactly when we're coming, when was it crystallized? When is the Bible canonized? Yes. And why do they leave it if they know about this? By the way, when you read the Bible, and here is my book, occasional you will have asterisks. Can you see? You are my witness. There is asterisks on the bottom, and it indicates to you what is the problem in the text. But they do not change it, and I'll explain to you why. So, okay, that is, I told you this, I just can't believe this sentence is so beautiful. In English, I don't know if it's a good English, but it's whatever is my faith is complete. So even whatever he will do to me, God will do, then my faith is complete. And that's the essence of the Bible. So of course, no wonder that this is the first printed edition of the Bible, isn't it? Now, why don't we change the arrows? And that's to answer Cynthia. What happens is, in the rise of Christianity, I'm not talking yet when Christianity really took over from 300 onwards, when the mother of the Roman really influenced it. I'm talking about the beginning at around 150 or something years before of the Common Era. There was a Rabbi Akiva, and he realized suddenly that from the apostles and the followers, this is not anymore a small sect of Judaism. This is getting bigger. And he realized that we need to separate it. If you want Judaism to be swallowed into the new wave, into Christianity, then just go along. But if you want to keep it as the old way, there's going to be a breakaway, but nevertheless, then we'll have to keep the text carefully, very carefully. So he said the famous idiom, never are we to touch even the edge of the yota, al kot social yud. A yud, yota, is the smallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet. So it says not only that you're not allowed to change the yud, but the edge of the yud. And that's to answer you also. If I ask you, Cynthia, do you think they still added mother lectiones, etc. after? No. Obviously, when he said no, it was totally accepted. He was such a big scholar. So, as the text was at 135, that is the text that we have today. Meanwhile, of course, they became more clever. They needed, they can realize there are mistakes, and etc., etc., but they can't touch it anymore. So they put asterisks, and they said, be careful, this is this. You remember I told you the Bible is 304,901, but it's actually 903 words. So why did they not just put it in?
because at Rabbi Akiva time he said, "Do not touch, do not change." Okay? It was to preserve Judaism, and indeed it is. The decree resulted in two things. Number one is the preservation of the authentic Hebrew Bible. And this is amazing. There are families that it's called the Masoretic families, families that gave up their lives. They only copied the Bible carefully, and to keep the text as it is, they are so, they are so religious about this, that is it. But of course, it also immortalized some of the errors. Now, this you understand, because, of course, if they discover the error, but they cannot change it, but that's why their work is to indicate it and without changing it. Now, what happened? Less and less people spoke Hebrew as mother tongue. Not everybody is living in Israel. So what did they do? They have to have a system, vowel system, which does not touch the text. Are you with me? Now, if you need a vowel, but you're not allowed to put it in the text, so they say, okay, let's be more clever. Let's put it above the text and below the text. Then they do not touch the original text. And look at this, I can read, Vayehi, Bimesh, Fota Shoftim, it's the book of Ruth. But look, every time that you have A, it's a line, or this one, like a little V, underneath the word. So this is Va, this is Va, Na, Ma, Ra, Da, the Tzehuda, Tisha, Er, Shem, Ha-Achat, Ha-Achat, Ha-A-A. Are you with me? Every line is A, every dot is A dot above is O. Dick is genius. Admit it. This is my Bible. That's what he is keeping for me. No, the O, there is also, no? It's a special, the O they put it, if the vowel, if the vowel letters, the is existing already, they skip the O in the middle. If it doesn't exist yet, because they are not allowed to add or take, then they make one, two, three dots that are sideways. But don't you think, I think this is a genius. If you are not allowed to touch the text, you can work around it. But that also explained to you, I asked many Israelis, tell me, why are our vowels above and below? And nobody knows. So that is it. Now, well, we are almost finished, guys. I'm actually almost. The Bomber's Bible. You know, of course, that if you saw the message from the book of Job, etc., this is a real book to keep. So when they had to have the first book that came out of the printing press, there was it was the Hebrew one. Now the first one that you know from Gutenberg, it's not the Hebrew one. It's the Latin. That's why I'm not emphasizing it, because I wanted people to give you the history of the script. But the first one that was in Hebrew, it was a Daniel Bumber from Antwerpen. He went to Venice and he opened a printing press. And the first book to come out of the printing press were the Torah and the five scrolls. Now, here we come to the most important, and then we're finishing. He commissioned a person by the name of Yaakov Ben Chaim Adoniyahu. He was from Tunis. I don't know if you spell like this, but you know Tunisia, the North Africa. He called this man who was a scholar, and he said to him, "Can you prepare for me the Bible for print?" So Ben Chaim Adoniyahu, he prepared a synthetic edition. And here I need to tell you, what is a synthetic edition? He took copies of different Bibles from around the world. He got from Holland, he got from North Africa, he got from Israel, from Mesopotamia, from Iraq, etc. He got 16 copies. And he put them, that's what I do by the way when I study something, a chapter. I always open all my Bibles and I see the different translation, what words they use. And that's how you find really translators as very free-spirited people. But anyway, what he done, he took the Hebrew ones. So there is not many differences. But there are. Because maybe a copier forgot things or ate things. Now he has 16. How did he fix the edition to print? By majority. So if out of the 16, there is a word missing in you, and you find it, a similar word is missing, and this. But three do not use this word, does not exist in your body. But the other 13 have it.
then he put it in. But can you see slowly how we're distancing ourselves from God's word? Because suddenly it's synthetic, guys. It's synthetic. It's not anymore the
utterance of God. So I explained synthetic edition. So now, just to tell you, every printed Bible today is actually a synthetic edition. So the last question of this course, I'm making it. Now, after we know a little bit more about the book of all books, are we going to buy any books, any book that supports the theory that there is a hidden message if you count letters and spaces in the biblical text? If the books which are under scrutiny are in English or any other translation, the answer is clearly no, because the words that are recorded are not God's word, but rather a reflection of the translators' personalities, their social experience, or their biases. And anyway, they are redone every few years, isn't it? Number two, what happens if it's in Hebrew? On one hand, the text is comparatively static, because we know, you remember from 135 when Rabbi Akiva said, on the edge of the Yota, nothing is changed since then. So you can say, wow, that's really ancient. Alas, Hebrew vowel letters were added unsystematically. And when they stopped using Hebrew as mother tongue, when they stopped and they needed help in reading. And after all, it is, from Ben Chaim Adoniyahu onwards, it is a synthetic edition. Do you remember his version? So why did we spend the whole week studying the Book of All Books?